Now entering a world where stories end and new beginnings arrive. A world where eventually all life must perish, but eventually will find a way of renewal in its previous state. A world where currently, right now, a month must fade away once again, and a new one to take its place. You are now entering the Ultra Nerd Podcast. Hello, everyone. My name is Zane, your gracious host, and welcome to the final episode of the spooky month of the Ultra Nerd Podcast. Today is going to be a little bit different. Join me in reading two short stories of H.P. Lovecraft. So please, sit down, grab some tea, and settle down to the terrible stories that he has bequeathed us. The Terrible Old Man by H.P. Lovecraft. It was the design of Agro Rick and Joe Kanak and Malvo Silva to call on the terrible old man. This old man dwells all alone in a very ancient house on Water Street near the sea, and is reputed to be both excitingly rich and exceedingly feeble, which forms a situation very attractive to men of the professions of mears. Ricky, Canex, and Silva, for the professions was nothing less dignified than robbery. The inhabitants of Kingsport say think many about the terrible old man, which generally keep him safe from the attention of gentlemen like Mr. Ricky and his colleagues. Despite almost certain fact that he hides a fortune of infinite magnitude somewhere about his musty and variable abode. He is in truth a very strange person, believed to have been a captain of the East India clipper ships in his days, so old that no one can remember when he was young, and so taciturn that he few know his real name. Among the general trees in the front yards of his age and neglected place of his maintains, a strange collection of large stones, oddly grouped and painted so that they resemble the idols in some obscure eastern temple. The collection frightens away most of the small boys who love to taunt the terrible old man about his long white hair and beard, or break the small panel windows of his dwellings with wicked missiles. But there are other things which frighten the older and more curious folk who sometimes steal up to the house to peer through the dusty panes. These folks say that on the table in a bare room on the ground floor are many peculiar bottles, and each of the small pieces of lead suspended pendulum-wise from the string. And they say that the terrible old man talks to these bottles, addressing them as such as Jack, Scarface, Long Tom, Spanish Joe, Peters, and Mate Ellis. And whatever he speaks to the bottles, the little lead pendulum within makes a certain definite vibration, as if in those it answers. Those who have watched the tall, lean, terrible man in this particular conversation do not watch him again. But Angelo, Ricky, Joe's Knack, and Mavenu Silva were not of Kingsport blood. They were that of new heritage alien stock which lies outside the charmed circles of New England life and tradition. And they saw in the terrible old man merely as a tottering, almost helpless graybeard, who cannot walk without the aid of his knotted cane, and those thin, weak hands shook pitifully. They were really quiet, sorry in their way for the lonely, unpopular old fellow, whom every day shunned, and at whom all the dogs barked singularly. But business is business, and to Rob, whose soul is in his profession, there is a lure and a challenge about a very old and very feeble old man who has no account at the bank, and who pays for a few necessities at the village store with Spanish gold and silver, minted 2 centuries ago. Messer Ricky and Connex and Silva selected the night of April 11th for their call. Mr. Ricky, Mr. Silva, were to interview the poor old gentleman. Wishless Mr. Connex waited for them and pursued personable metallic burden with the covered motor car in the ship street. By the gate in the tall rear wall of the host's garden, desires to avoid needless expansions in the case of unexpected police intrusion prompted these plans for a quiet and unsuspicious departure. As paraged, the three adventurers started out separately in order to prevent any evil-minded suspicious afterward. Messrs. Ricky and Silva met in Water Street by the old man's front gate. Although they did not like the way the moon shone down upon the white painted stones through the bubbling branches of the gnarled trees, they had more important things to think about than mere idle superstitions. They feared it might be the unpleasant work making the terrible old man Longquist's concerning his hoarded gold and silver. For aged sea captains are notable, stubborn, and perversible. Still was very old and very feeble, and there were 2 visitors. Messrs. Ricky and Silva were experienced in the art of making unwilling persons vulnerable, and the screams of a weak and unexpected vulnerable man can be easily muffled. So they moved up to one of the light windows and heard the terrible old man talking childishly to the bottles with the pendulums. Then they donned masks and knocked politely at the weather-stained oak door. Waited seemed very long to Mr. Knax as he fidgeted restlessly in the covered motor car by the terrible old man's gate in Ship Street. He was more than ordinarily tendered heated, and he did not like the hideous screams he had heard in the ancient house just after appointed for the deed. He had not told his colleagues to be as gentle as possible with the pathetic old sea captain. Very nervously, he had watched the narrow oak gate in the high, ivy-clad stone wall. Frequently, he has consulted his watch and wondered at the delay. Had the old man died before revealing where his treasure was hidden, and had a thorough search become necessary? Mr. Connack did not like to wait so long in the dark in such a place. Then he sensed the soft tread or tapping on the walk inside the gate, heard a gentle fumbling and a rustling latch, and saw a narrow, heavy door swing inward. And in the plaid glow of the single, dim street lamp, he strained his eyes to see what his colleagues had brought out of that sinister house which loomed so close behind. But when he looked, he did not see that what he had expected for his colleagues were not there at all, but the terrible old man, leaning quietly at his knotted cane and smiling hideously. Mr. Connack had never before noticed the colors of this man's eyes. Now he saw that they were yellow. Little things considerable excitement in the little town, which in the reason that Kingsport people talked all the spring and summer about 3 unidentifiable bodies, horribly slashed with many cutlasses and horribly mangled as by the tread of many curled boot heels, which the tide washed in, and some people even spoke of things as a trivial and as a deserted motor car found in the ship street, or certain especially inhuman cries, probably of a stray animal or migrant bird heard in the night by the wakeful citizens. But this idle village gossip the terrible old man took no interest at all. He was by nature reversed, and when one is aged and feeble, one's reserve is doubly strong. Besides, so ancient a sea captain must have witnessed scores of things much more stirringly in the far-off days of his unrememberable youth. The Terrible Old Man by H.P. Lovecraft. Dagon by H.P. Lovecraft. I am writing this under an appreciable mental strain, since by tonight I shall be no more. Penniless at the end of my supply of the drug, which alone makes life endurable. I can bear the torture no longer, and I shall cast myself from this grand window into the squabble street below. Do not think from my slavery to morphine that I am a weakling or a degenerate. When you have read these harshly scribbled pages, you may guess, though you fully realize, why it is that I must have fully forgotfulness or death. It was in one of those most open, least frequent parts of the board Pacific that a packet of which I was full supercargo fell a victim to the German sea raider. The Great War was then at its very beginning, and the ocean forces of the Hun had not completely sunk to their later degradation, so that our vessel was made a legitimate prize. We of her crew were treated with all the fairness and consideration due as a naval prisoners. So liberal indeed was the discipline of our captors that 5 days after we were taken, I have managed to escape alone in a small boat with water, provisions for a good length of time. When I finally found myself adrift and free, I had but little idea of my surroundings. Never a competent navigator, I could only guess vaguely by the sun and the stars that I was somewhat south of the equator. Of the longitude, I know nothing, and that no island or coastline was in sight. The weather kept fair for uncounted days. I drifted aimlessly beneath the scorching sun, waiting either for some passing ship or to be cast on the shores of some habitable land, but neither ship nor land appeared, and I began to despair in my solitude upon the heaving fast of the unbroken blue. The change happened whilst I slept. Its details I shall never know, for my slumber through the terrible and dream-infested was continuous. When I was at last awoken, it was discovered myself half-sunken into a slimy expansion of a hellish black mire which extended about me into the mortuous undulationist as far as I could see, and in which my boat lay grounded some distance away. Though one might well imagine that my first sensation would be of wonder at so prodigious and unexpected a transformation of scenery, I was in realization more horrified than astonished. For there was in the air and in the rotting soil a sinister quality which chilled me to the very core. The region was putrid with the carcasses of decaying fish and other of the less describable things which I saw protruding from the nasty mud of the unending plain. Perhaps I should not hope to convey in a mere words of unutterable hideousness that, sorry, can dwell in absolute silence and barren immensity. There was nothing within hearing and nothing in sight, save a vast reach of black slime. Yet the very completeness of the stillness and the homogeneity of the landscape oppressed me with the necessity of fear. The sun was blazing down from the sky, which seemed to me almost black in its cloudless cruelty, as though reflecting the inky marsh beneath my feet. As I crawled into the stranded boat, I realized that was my only theory could explain my position. Through some unprecedented volcanic upheaval, a portion of the ocean floor must have been thrown to the surface, exposing regions which were for innumerable millions of years had land hidden under unfathomable watery depths. So great was the extent of the new land which had risen beneath me that I could not detect the faintest noise of surging ocean. Strain my ears as I might, nor were there any seafowl to prey upon the dead things. For several hours I sat thinking or brooding in the boat, which lay upon its side, affordable a slight shade as the sun moved across the heavens. As the day progressed, the ground lost some of its stickiness and seemed like to dry sufficiently for traveling purposes in a short time. That night I slept, but a little. And the next day I made for myself a pact of containing food and water, preparatory to an overland journey in search of a vanished sea and possible rescue. On the third morning, I found the soil dry enough to walk upon with ease. The odor of fish was maddening, but I was too much concerned with graving things to mind so slightly an evil and set out boldly for an unknown goal. All day I forged steadily westward, guided by a faraway hummock which rose higher than any other elevation on the rolling desert. That night I encamped, and on the following day still traveled towards the hummock. Though the object seemed scarcely nearer than I had first espied it, by the fourth evening I attained the base of mound, which turned out to be much higher than it had appeared from the distance. An intervening valley setting it out in sharper relief from the general surface. Too weary to ascend, I slept in the shadow of the hill. I know not why my dreams were so wild that night, but ere the waning and the fascinatingly gibbous moon had risen far above the eastern, fantastically gibbous moon had risen far above the eastern plain, I was awakened in a cold presentation, determined to sleep no more. Such visions as I experienced were too much for me to endure again. In the glow of the moon, I saw how unwise I had been to travel by day. Without the glare of the parching sun, my journey would cost me less energy. Indeed, I know I felt quite able to perform. The ascent which had deterred me at sunset, picking up my pack, I started for the crest of the eminence. I have said that the unbroken monotony of the rolling plain was a source of vague horror to me, but I think my horror was greater than I gained the summit of the mound and looked down the other side into an immeasurable pit of canyon, whose black resinous the moon had not yet soared high enough to illuminate. I felt myself on the edge of the world, peering over the rim into the fathomless chaos of the eternal night. Though my terror ran curious, reminiscence of paradise, loss and of a satanic, hideous climb through the unfashionable realms of darkness. As the moon climbed higher in the sky, I began to see that the slopes of this valley were not quite so perpendicular, however you pronounce it, as I had imagined. Ledges and outcroppings of the rock afforded fairly easy footholds for a descent. Whilst after a drop of a few hundred feet, the declivity became very gradual, urged on the by impulse which I cannot definitely analysis. I scrambled with the difficulty down the rocks and stood on the gentle slopes beneath, gazing in the sun into the game, deeps where no light had yet penetrated. All at once, my attention was captured by a vast, singular object on the opposite slope, which rose steeply about 100 yards ahead of me. An object that gleamed whitely in the newly bestowed rays of ascending moon. That it was merely a gigantic piece of stone, I soon assured myself, but I was curious of distinct impression that its contours and positions were not, although, the work of nature. A closure of security filled me with sensations that I cannot express, for despite enormous magnitude and its positions in an abyss which had yawned at the bottom of the sea, since the world was young, I perceived beyond a doubt that the strange object was a well-shaped monolith, whose massive bulk had known the workmanship and perhaps the worship of living, thinking creatures. Dazed and frightened, yet not without a certain thrill of the scientist or archaeologist's delight, I examined my surroundings more closely. The moon, now near the zenith, shone weirdly and vividly above the towering steeps that behind in the chasm, and revealed the facts of the far-flung body of water flowed at the bottom, winding out of sight in both directions and almost lapping my feet as I stood on the slope. Across the chasm, the wavelengths washed a base of the Cleopine monolith, so whose surface I could now trace both instructionable and crudely sculptures. The writing was in a system of hieroglyphs unknown to me and unlike anything I had ever seen in books, consisting of the most parts of conventional aquatic symbols such as fishes, eels, octopi, crustaceans, mollusks, whales, and the like. Several characters obviously represented marine things, which are unknown to the modern world, but whose decomposing forms I had observed on the ocean-risen plain. It was the particular carvings, however, that did most to hold me spellbound, plainly visible across the intervening water on account of their enormous size, where an array of bas reliefs whose subject would have excited the envy of a Dor. I think that these things were supposed to depict men, at least, a sort of men, though the creatures were shrewd to supporting like fishes in the water of some marine grotto or paying homage of some monolithic shrine which appeared to be the under waves as well. Of their face and forms, I dare not to speak in detail. For the mere remembrance makes me grow faint, grotesque beyond the imagination of Poe or Bellew. They were damnable human in general outline. Despite webbed hands and feet, shockingly wide and flappable lips, glassy, bulging eyes, and other features less pleasant to recall. Curiously enough, they seem to have one of these creatures was shrew in the act of killing a whale represented. Wait, crap, what's the line? Yeah. Curiously enough, they seem to have been chiseling back. Oh, wait, no, I did read that line, sorry. I remarked, as I say, their grotesque and strange size, but in the moment decided that they were merely the imaginary of gods and some primitive fish or seafaring tribe. Some tribes who last descended had perished eras before the first ancestors of Pit Town or Netherall Man. The Netherall Man was born. Aru struck at this unexpected glimpse into the past. The concept of the most daring anthropologist I have stood musing with lists the moon cast queer reflections on this silent channel before me. Suddenly I saw it, with only a slight chummering to mark. It rises to the surface. Thing slid into the view above the dark waters, vast, polymyth-like, and lonesome. It started like stubborous monsters of nightmares, and the monolith which about it flung in its gigantic scaly arms, the wild bowed its hideous head and gave a vent into a certain measured sound. I think I went mad then. On the frantic ascent of the slope and the cliff of my delirious journey back to the stranded boat, I remembered little. I believe I sang a great deal and laughed oddly when I was unable to sing. I have indistinctly recollections of a great storm sometime after I reached the boat. At any rate, I know I had heard the peals of thunder and the other tones which nature utter only in the wildest moods. When I came out of the shadows, I was in San Francisco's hospital, brought thinner by the captain of the American ship which had picked up my boat in mid-ocean. In delirium, I had said much, but found that my words have been given saint attention of my land unheaval in the Pacific. My rescuers know nothing, nor did I deem it unnecessary to insist upon a thing which I knew they could not believe. Once I sought an auxiliary etymologist and amused him with peculiar questions regarding ancient philosophy and legends of Dagon, the fish god. But soon perceiving that he was hopeless conventional, I did not press my inquisitors. It is at night, especially when the moon is gibbous and the warming, that I see the thing which went worthy. But the drug, it was only transient, securus, and has drawn me into its clutches at the hopeless slave. So now I am at the end, amusement of my fellow men. Often I ask myself if it could not all have been a pure fantasm. a mere freak of a fever as I lay sunken, stricken, raving in the open boat after my escape from the German man of war. This, I ask myself, but ever does there come before me a hideously vivid vision in reply? I cannot think of the deep sea without shuddering at the nameless things that I may at this very moment be crawling, floundering on its slippery bed, worshipping their ancient stone idols and carvings their own despicable likenesses on a submarine obelisk of the water-soaked granite. I dream of a day when they may rise above the bellows to drag down in their reeking talons of the remnants of the puny war-exhausted mankind. Of a day the land shall sink, and the dark ocean floor shall ascend amidst universal pandemonium, and the end of it is near. I hear the noises at the door. It's a mere immense body blundering against it. God, that hand, the window.
Dagon by H.P. Lovecraft. I would like to thank all of you for joining me on this journey into the mind of H.P. Lovecraft and to joining me in all the Halloween celebrations to the channel. Before I end the podcast, I just want to say I would like to thank you for listening with me. And I also want to say as a quick announcement, I will not be posting another episode tomorrow because school comes first. But besides just that, after this week, next week shall be the normal schedule for me posting episodes on a Sunday. And please, have a happy Halloween.